The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at News Talk Science, and we get to all of those comments and emails later on in the podcast where we sort of refer back to last week's episode. This week, we're going to be speaking to a guy called Sam Kriegman. He is from the University of Vermont, and he studies something called evolutionary robotics. He's worked on a paper where they've developed sort of something living, but also sort of a robot, but not sort of something in between. And it's called a Xenobot. I think if you're anything like me, it will change your understanding of how living things work. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio are Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher, both from UCD, as it happens. You're both very welcome, guys. Our first story.
The future. The polar ice caps have melted, covering the Earth with water. Those who survived have adapted to a new world.
That is, of course, the opening to Waterworld, Kevin Costner's greatest movie.
Yeah, I liked it.
Mm-hmm. And and this is a story about not the future of a water world, but actually the past, Shane.
Yeah, so scientists have discovered recently in a remote part of Australia that the world may have been entirely covered in water about 3 billion years ago.
So what?
Yeah, so they found there's this part of Australia that's very remote. Well, lots of parts of Australia are remote. This is particularly remote, where the rock here has kind of split. And so what was once the ocean bed is now jutting up out, like, you know, so that geologists can go in and they can actually take a look at it and dig it up. And they've looked at the minerals that are in there, and they've been able to tell what the ocean bed would have looked like 3 billion years ago. So they're looking for chemical clues in there. In particular, they're looking for isotopes of oxygen. So isotopes decay over a certain amount of time. So they're looking for things like oxygen 16 or oxygen 18, particular kind of rare types of oxygen in there. And they're able to look for the amount of those present. And they see that 3 billion years ago, there was a lot of oxygen 16 present. And they know that that means that there wasn't a lot of land around, because oxygen 16, when it's created, is swallowed up or is nullified by clay on solid ground. And they're saying because there was lots of this isotope present in the rock, they know that there wasn't a lot of land, and they're surmising that the Earth was more or less covered entirely in water.
So there was, like, there were no land masses that rose above
nothing,
above sea level.
Nothing to kind of, you know, no continent. There may have been islands like, you know, Hawaii or the Galapagos are now, like little dots, but nothing on the kind of Eurasian landmass scale or anything like that.
Is that a new idea? Because that I haven't heard that before.
It is, yes. And so what they are saying is that that's very interesting, because we have to think now about how life on Earth may have started. And if we had a world that was entirely covered in water, and cellular life was beginning in this sort of setup, then would that give us a kind of where to look on other worlds if we're going to look for life on exoplanets? Or indeed, might it tell us something about what's happening under the ocean, given that the world is entirely covered in water, and that this balance of land and sea that we have at the moment allows for a certain sort of biochemistry that would not have existed back then, and that may have resulted in cellular life getting a kickstart.
I see. And are there other experiments we can do to validate this idea that the Earth was not a green planet originally, but a blue marble of water?
Well, and I'm speculating here because they don't refer to that in the paper. I suppose the presence of this isotope is what they found here. And that's only one clue. So they could look for other clues that are associated with rock or with when you dig up out of the ground, the geology, that's it. When they could look for geological clues. The isotope thing is very interesting, though, when you think about it, because discovering isotopes and understanding radioactivity answered the greatest question of 19th century science. The age of the Earth was the greatest question in science in the 19th century. We had no idea how old the Earth was. And the best mechanism we had was looking at how the big giant ball was cooling, and assuming that it was cooling at a steady rate, it was so old. And we massively got that wrong. And it was when we discovered radioactivity and isotopes and we were able to look at the decay of isotopes over time, we were for the first time ever able to give a very accurate measure of the Earth's age, which is 4.5 billion years, not a couple of thousand years, as the Bible suggests.
What about this water then? If the world was covered in water, where did all that water go?
Volcanoes.
Huh?
Yeah, so the continents, when the Earth was young, right, it was covered in water, they're saying in this paper, but all of the land came out of volcanoes, right? So it erupted out from under the crust, and that slowly has formed continents. And the earliest continent that we would have, continental material we have, is around the 3 billion years old. So every bit of land on the Earth has come since then, and it's come from volcanoes.
Ah, so the water hasn't gone anywhere. The Earth has just come up from out
exactly.
underneath it.
Yeah.
I see. Susan, your story this week is about CRISPR and a new use for it. That is obviously one of the potential uses that we've been thinking about for some time.
So this is very welcomed, I suppose, in the scientific medical community to see this really being used. So as we know, CRISPR-Cas9 is this gene editing tool that allows you to take a piece of DNA, cut out a faulty section, and then put in a new piece. Now, this week, a patient with congenital blindness underwent a procedure at the KCI Institute in Portland, where the DNA editing was done directly in their body. And in fact, it was done in their eye. And they underwent an hour-long surgery where 3 drops of fluid containing the toolbox for the gene editing was entered through a tube as wide as a hair, the width of a hair, into just beneath the retina at the back of the eye. And this is where the cells which cause the blindness are. And they can't produce a specific protein which converts light into signals in the brain, and so that causes blindness. And then this treatment now is shown to fix these cells by reprogramming them to now produce the protein.
Presumably that has been done in mice.
So it's actually been done in clinical trials. So it's so this is what's really interesting about this is the first public patient that's undergone the treatment. So this has gone through really successful trials, clinical trials that showed really excellent results for the delivery of this drug into essentially it is a drug, the protein into the eye. It is the first FDA approved gene therapy for genetic diseases. So it's a huge milestone that it's now available. You know, obviously it's costly and there's only specific patients that are eligible for it, or they have to have certain conditions to be able to undergo it. But it's a huge landmark kind of case where they're saying this can now actually be used in hospitals.
When you say the first public case, what is this patient's name and how long is he, what are you shaking your head
for? Yes, because that has not been disclosed to us. I suppose this person is still undergoing treatment. They do one eye, then they do the other eye, but then they have to wait and see if this person has an outcome. They know from the trials what they gave people. In the clinical trials, they gave people the drug, and within a year or 2 year follow up, they showed huge improvement in what's this called, this multi-luminal mobility test, where ultimately they get the patients to walk through a maze in low lighting. And before they undergo the treatment, they don't manage to do this very well because their eyesight's so poor or they're completely blind. And then 1 year later, it's really remarkable. You can see videos on the website of the company that produces this drug where they can now do this maze. It's really amazing. So I suppose this person's privacy is important as well, and in time we'll hear more about the real cases.
Now, this is a form of inherited blindness. So it's a genetic type of blindness. This person then presumably has never seen?
So this specific type of disorder starts with very, very low sight levels and decreases. But it's within the first few years of life. And so it's blindness to the point where they can see maybe shadows and differences in contrast, I suppose, but not complete and utter blindness, because obviously it's a slightly different disorder to maybe some other ones.
And the outcome is they can see slightly better, or they can see like you.
Yeah,
and I.
So what they can do is I suppose their test that they said is this test where they walk through the maze, and after 2 years, 85% of patients can now go through this maze.
Can they read? What a weird test! Like, when am I ever going to go and walk through a maze in low light?
I mean, it is the test that they use in this low light to say, can you see? And it's in low light, so it's like, can you now, you know, on a dark night, work through this maze, or can you work out, you know?
Can they read, Susan? Can they actually read?
You're touching on something that's very philosophical. There was this thing called the Molyneux problem, which they worked on in 18th century Trinity, where an Irish philosopher, actually he was a physicist, said if a blind person suddenly got sight, would they know what an apple was just by looking at it, based on the fact they would have felt it and had this sort of touch description for the whole thing? Would they know that's an apple without touching it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that person could definitely like fulfill that Molyneux problem. We should get them to do that.
Yes, and I don't know specifics of reading up like small print, but I do know as part of this test there are arrows on the ground they have to follow. You have right. to go around obstacles. So, I mean, they can see a certain level, perhaps not full sight.
No, I guess while it's exciting, it's great that this patient underwent it. I suppose the question is, what's the end? Is the end goal, are they actually going to be able to see, or are they basically going to bump into furniture? Which I'm very genuinely
no,
like.
I think
is that,
it's, yeah, no, it, I mean, it certainly is an excellent improvement on their ability to see, and it most certainly will have enormous positive outcomes for people with this disorder.
Second story for you, Shane, has to do with NASA, and this is a rekindling of human space exploration.
Yeah, so NASA are hoping to go back to the moon by 2024, and from there they want to launch other missions to, I guess, to Mars. And to do that, they need new astronauts. So since the NASA program started in the 60s, they have recruited 350 astronauts. There's about 50 who are currently in service at the moment who could go up into space if needed. But NASA are kind of looking for new people. They have this cool job advert that's going, and they're saying for the month of March, anyone can apply to become an astronaut. But when I say anyone, do you want to hear what's on the kind of, you know,
okay,
candidates may wish to apply with the following? So you need to have a master's qualification in STEM, right? And we're always pushing
check.
That. Yeah, check. Or a PhD.
You now need, there's a reason to have that.
Absolutely. Up to now, it was just kind of random stuff. You could be a medical doctor or an osteopathic doctor. You have to have been a test pilot. So, yeah, that probably rules you out.
You have to have been a test pilot.
Yeah. So
you have to have been a test pilot.
Absolutely.
And a doctor. But anybody can apply.
Anyone at all who has like a PhD, maybe a medical degree, and is a test pilot.
Why do you need to have, I suppose you can have a doctor. You don't need to be a doctor, but you need a STEM master's.
Yeah.
So Dr. Nora Patton fits that bill very well.
She does. And Dr. Niamh Shaw does as well, who wants to be the first Irish person to go to space. Dr. Niamh Shaw may also be a test pilot. I don't know. Like, we could ring her and ask her. But there are lots of actual people in Ireland who would love to be the first Irish astronaut. Yeah, so we could maybe, you know, maybe your program could help find those people. It could be an ex, like, Pop
Idol. Is it all ex? Is it all ex Ryanair staff? Like, is that? I mean, like, is that what, like, if you have to be a test pilot, like, who? I mean, how do you just fall into being a test pilot?
You
I guess
need
it's
to
just
be
American
in the Air
military.
Corps.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when the it's
anybody, it, but
do you know what? It's wonderful NASA PR as ever, and the European Space Agency, as we've joked many times, could learn from NASA as to how they connect with the public. This is a great piece of PR because they're saying anyone could apply. You too could be the next astronaut.
When actually they have a list of Susan, Terry, Mike, or Bob.
Not this Susan.
Who they know very well.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you'd be a great astronaut, Susan.
Thank you.
Our final story has to do with mums.
Yes. So I have a question for you, Jonathan. If I gave you 6 t-shirts worn by 6 different kids, would you be able to identify the one that belonged to your own child by smelling it?
Maybe
we should have done this.
Yeah. Sounds like
I don't
a job
know that many children to take t-shirts
producer
from.
Amy.
So there's a study just out of Dresden, published in Frontiers of Psychology, that reports that mothers are really very good at this, and that they can generally identify clothing that belong to younger kids, and they also identify it as smelling cute. Which is really quite sweet as a mum as well, I can understand.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
I think I'd be able to get like babies.
Baby smells.
Because there's a sort of a palette of odours
there
that
is.
Come with babies.
Yes.
And let's see, I think I identify that. I don't know, like 7 to 11?
Older, yes.
Well, actually 7 to 11, I suppose, is the absence of that sort of sweet and not the sour and gross.
You're hitting on exactly the point. They did actually say in previous work as well that fathers, they didn't look at them in this study, but fathers do rate to be really good at IDing infants' smells, exactly as you just described. But this does change when the kids, or after the kids, have hit puberty. And when the smells all of a sudden become intense, and we know that that's not a an intense smell is not a good smell, and less pleasant on the rating of niceness. So the science behind it is 164 mothers were given the 6 items of clothing from children, all the same sex as their own child, which was also in the study, but they had 2 age cohorts. They said the prepubescent children, they chose basically 0 to 8, and then the postpubescent, which were the older teens. And that is because that middle, as you said, the middle ground isn't the young baby smell, nor is it the pungent teenage smell. And mothers were really good at differentiating between those 2 cohorts of smells. But just like that, by, just as strangers, this is children they don't know, and blind smelling of clothing.
So you're saying teenagers smell a bit.
Yes.
Yeah, but like that's...
links.
That's not really... that's not really science, is it?
So, I mean, well, we could all say, you know, people smell a bit, but this was a study done. I mean, it's not going to change
just
the
just because
the
study was done, does it make it
I
science,
appreciate
Susan?
That point. But
why is it
important?
Useful?
I suppose one thing what they're saying is that understanding why smell is important in development of relationships. And we know that, for example, you know, the bonding that takes place a lot of the time with mothers and children is a lot to do with sense of smell and connection at that level. And if there are difficulties in bonding with mothers and children, this study has suggested that maybe stimulating the olfactory senses to produce a positive response could be a benefit. They also say, conversely, that in the teenage years, they think that maybe they're hypothesizing that this, you know, less pleasant smell could be to do with the sense of detachment that teenagers ultimately get and ultimately need from parents.
What?
Well, because they're saying that.
No,
because
they stink. Because they sweat.
But
they're sweating.
But why is the smell?
Because they're starting to sweat.
Yes, but why is the smell there? Like, that's the question. Yes, they sweat, but why are they sweating?
Because it's bacteria that... it's bacteria's waste, right? It's the alcohol.
I have two things for you, Jonathan. Number one, if this were true, then surely 30-year-olds living at home would reek, right? That's one thing, because you just really want to get rid of them. But secondly, you are becoming the reviewer that Susan and I have to deal with for all of our publications.
Reviewer two.
He's reviewer two.
He is reviewer
it's like,
two,
this
yes.
isn't science. And then Susan is like, oh my God, I have to justify my work.
You did mention the 30-year-old, but of course, it, you know, it doesn't really matter that sense of, you know, as you get to your 18, whether or not your mother thinks you smell good. The point is, some other... I'm assuming attractive woman is your mother, but an attractive mate is going to enjoy your smell. And we know that that's essential in attraction and essential in being, you know, attracted to people is their scent. And so there's possibly a good clear break between who finds your smell attractive as you get older.
Smells like teen spirit, essentially. no, that didn't work very well. is there a way of wrapping this up well and moving on? Dr. Susan Callagher from UCD, Dr. Shane Berger, thank you very much. Now, I'm alive, your dog is alive, the ginormous spider keeping you from going to your bathroom is also alive. But although you may find yourself shouting obscenities at them, your smartphone, your laptop, or your local automated supermarket checkout is not alive. It seems self-evident that there is a divide between machine and life, but for how long will that last? Sam Kriegman is a PhD student in evolutionary robotics, if that's such a thing, at the University of Vermont. He's lead author of a new paper on so-called xenobots. He joins me now. Sam, welcome to the program. What on earth are xenobots?
Thank you for having me. I can assure you that evolutionary robotics is a real thing, and xenobots are a great example of it. So xenobots are the world's first computer-designed organisms. They're very small, about the size of a grain of sand, and at the moment, they're also very simple. They're composed of just 2 things, frog skin cells and frog heart cells. The skin cells provide a rigid structure, and the heart cells act like tiny pistons, contracting and expanding in volume to propel the xenobot forward. But now suppose you want a xenobot to perform a specific task, like pushing a pellet from one location in its petri dish to another. Well, one of the things we realized was that we could simply treat the skin and heart cells like microscopic Lego bricks. They'll stick together in a desired pattern, and they can be sculpted into just about any 3-dimensional shape, so we can build them. But you might ask, what should a pellet-pushing organism look like? What overall shape should its body have, and where should its muscles be positioned within its body?
I have way more questions before we get to that one, Sam. So let's just take it a bit by bit. I thought something that has a frog skin and a frog heart and frog bits is a frog.
Yeah. So if you zoom in on a xenobot all the way down to the cell, it is a frog cell. It's 100% frog DNA, and we know exactly what it is. But as you zoom out and you see more of these cells, and you get to the level of the entire xenobot, which is about 5,000 cells, less than a millimeter across. If your listeners are familiar with tardigrades, it's about that size, yep. about the size of a grain of sand. And once you're at that level, it's clearly not a frog.
But when we think of organisms, they are structures. So they have organs and they have nervous systems and all that sort of stuff. Not all living things do, but frogs certainly do. So you're just taking frog cells and sticking them together. Surely that shouldn't work.
Yeah, so one of the first things we were surprised about was that this is possible and that skin and heart cells are enough to make a really simple organism. Of course, we could argue about whether or not this is an organism at all. And I think one of the interesting things about the xenobots is that they kind of force us to refine our definitions of what's an organism, what's a robot, what is life. And these are things we don't really have good definitions for. And you could argue this is just semantics, but I think that there can be really useful definitions and they can help us think about these things more clearly and advance the science if we can do it.
You say frog heart cells and frog skin cells, but surely there's more to it than just those two cells in these organisms.
Yeah, so if you look at these organisms and they're able to do some very simple tasks, but actually it looks kind of like complex behavior. The xenobots can move around, they can push pellets in their dish, and when you place a swarm of the xenobots together in the same dish and you place even smaller pellets in that dish, they'll spontaneously act like little sheepdog. They'll herd all of the little pellets into neat little piles. And we can ask, you know, how is this possible? They're only made of skin and heart cells. How are they doing this? They're such simple machines or technologies. Well, actually, the reason why this is possible is because they're made of cells. They're not made of metal and electronics. They're made out of cells, which are themselves really complex machines that have had practice over billions of years of doing things like that are useful and also healing themselves. So when we cut the xenobot almost in half, it heals. And these are things that most technologies can't do.
Okay, stop. I have so many. So is there a structure that holds them together? Is there some sort of goo or scaffold? Or did you literally just harvest some skin and heart cells and arrange them in shapes that could do stuff?
Yeah, you can tell I'm excited about this. Yeah, feel free to cut me off because I'll talk forever. but basically, one of the first things that we realized in this paper was that it was possible just to stick together different kinds of biological tissues into a coherent organism.
Wow.
So we didn't know that this was possible, that skin tissue would just stick to heart cells, to heart muscle tissue, and that we could sculpt this into, you know, different kinds of body shapes. So it turns out that this is possible. But then, you know, you have something that's moving in a random way. So you want to be able to program it to do something useful.
Okay.
If it's going to be a robot or a useful technology.
So you've used words there that might confuse people. You talked about programming, robot and technology. And yet you're talking about purely organic pieces. Now, if people are familiar with coding, they might know of Scratch or other types of coding where you can sort of use blocks of code to do things, and kids use this to code, and they use sort of blocks to make a game or whatever, as opposed to properly code. And it sounds to me that you're not genetically programming any of these cells. You're just like Scratch. You're sort of sticking cells together in the shapes you want to get them to perform sort of motor functions. Is that what's happening?
That's exactly right. So these organisms are programmed in the sense that they're designed to perform a specific task. So in the case of us using just skin and muscle cells, depending on the shape of the organism and the position of its muscle, you can get an organism to move in a straight line or in a circle or to team up with its buddies to push and coordinate the pellets in its dish. So they're programmed to do a specific task based on their design. Basically, it turns out that it's very difficult to design an organism from scratch or from a pile of cells. We know how the heart cells will behave and sync when they're in their default shape, which is an adult frog heart, but we don't know how the cells will behave and coordinate in new configurations. So it's kind of like trying to design a car with 100 wheels, and when you step on the accelerator, each of the 100 wheels spin forward, but they do so at their own random rate. Maybe some wheels sync and start to spin at the same speed, but other wheels continue to spin at their own pace. And we don't know where the wheels are going to sync, where they're just going to spin faster than others. So how would you design the shape of your car and the position of the wheels to ensure that the car moves in a straight line, regardless of how fast each of the individual wheels are spinning? It's a near impossible task for a human engineer to solve. But we found that an AI, an artificial intelligence program, can solve this problem.
Wow. So do you, when you talk about these different speeds, you're talking about the contraction speeds of cells that are muscle cells that are from a frog?
Yeah. So this metaphor is meant to illustrate that we don't know how the heart cells are going to sync. So when they're in the shape of a heart, they all beat as one.
Yeah.
But when we stretch kind of what these cells are expected to do and test their flexibility to make new kinds of bodies and new kinds of functions, we don't know how they'll behave or if they'll really synergize at all. And so the design task, it seems quite challenging. And that's where the AI comes into this.
So how do you... So you basically have these cells, you want to design a function for them, and you've used an AI program to sort of figure out the best way to configure them to do the tasks that you want them to do. But once you've done that, how do you create these so-called xenobots? Is it one by one, sort of sticking them together with a tweezers, or how do you make these xenobots hold the structure that you want them to do?
There are a number of ways we could build this. We can build them cell by cell. And that, as you can imagine, would take a very long time. But if we did it cell by cell, we could position them exactly where the computer says they should go. Or if we're kind of limited on the time we have, there's a quick and dirty method that we can use, which is basically to layer different whole tissues down, lots of cells at once, and you can make a kind of sandwich. You can go, here's a bunch of skin tissue, and then I'm going to put some heart tissue on top, and then skin tissue on top of that. And then you have this hunk of tissue, you let it develop for a little bit, and then you can kind of sculpt out by subtraction the shape that you want. So there's
this is not how life works. As far as I was aware, Sam, this is not how you get something living to work. It sounds very Frankensteinish.
Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely conjures up some of these stories. And actually, the first time the word robot was used, the way the robot was made was not with metal and electronics. It was actually made by organs and tissues like this. So in a way, we're kind of returning back to the origin of the word. And then in terms of how this differs from other kinds of synthetic biology, you know, we're not tinkering with the genetics at all.
So this isn't Craig Venter's area at all?
No. So these are just basically like frog Legos that you're sticking together into new ways. And although they're 100% frog ingredients, they're clearly not frogs. They look kind of just like blobs. If you look at them under a microscope, you can see they have, you know, different kinds of shapes depending on the blueprint that was designed by the AI. So they might have four legs, two legs, no legs. They might be a torus or a snake, et cetera, depending on what the good design is for the task they were designed for. But their skin kind of looks like, I guess you would expect frog skin to look like. They're not very impressive. It kind of looks like a popped kernel of popcorn. It's hard to kind of imagine this. But if I told you, you know, this is 100% frog DNA, I think biologists are a little bit surprised then when we zoom out to see what it actually looks like.
So it isn't really a robot. It's not an animal, but is it alive?
Okay. Well, it is made out of biological cells that are alive, and I think that it's alive. But then I'm not sure if the definition of life really depends on the thing that the object is made out of. So I don't think we have a good definition of life or robot or organism yet. So xenobots.
One of the things is something that is living can reproduce, and this cannot. Is that correct?
So these xenobots cannot reproduce, but they're also natural organisms that cannot reproduce, like mules. But it does seem like, so they're made out of cells, and cells can reproduce themselves, and they can develop.
Right.
So I don't know. It depends on your definition of life, whether or not they're living, and it depends on your definition of robot. So to me, these are robots. So they're not made out of the traditional robotic material, but they're programmed to do a specific thing, and they do it.
Are they? Can they only survive in liquid? Are they sort of aquatic because of the nature of the cells, or could you put these guys on a table?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So right now, the word xenobot comes from the fact that the cells that are used to make them come from Xenopus laevis, which is the African clawed frog. So Xenopus, xenobot. Xeno also means strange or other, so we feel like it's also a fitting name for these little guys. Hmm. But because they're these aquatic frog cells, the xenobots themselves live in an aqueous solution. But there's nothing special necessarily about this particular kind of frog, so they could be built out of other kinds of cells, including human cells. And that's something we're really keen on, because if we want clinical applications and robots that can go inside of our organisms or whatever to go inside of our body and deliver medicine or, you know, locate and treat disease, if they're made out of metal or electronics, our bodies are going to reject them very quickly. That's what our immune system was built to do. But if they're made out of our own cells, well, then they're a part of us. So our body would not reject them. So
You're suggesting to create human little, I mean, like ants in a way. You're suggesting to make ants out of human cells and then put them in our bodies.
Yeah, I kind of slipped that in there, right? And then I went right to the application. So yes, I do think that having small robots, so these are micro scale robots or organisms or xenobots, whatever we're calling these things, they're small enough to go inside of your body. But if they're made out of frog cells or if they're made out of metal, then our immune system is going to reject them. So we are suggesting in this paper that if they were built out of human cells or the patient's own cells, they could potentially perform tasks inside of our bodies without raising the alarm bells, as it were.
Yeah, without triggering an immune response, which would kill the robot that we want to do something good in our bodies. What are you talking about when you say functions? Like, what can we get these things to do?
Sure. So we already see when we place a swarm of multiple xenobots together in the same dish, and we also place in that dish smaller pellets and debris, the xenobots automatically tend to act like little sheepdog, and they herd those pellets into neat little piles.
Why?
So we don't know why, and that's something that is really exciting for us and mysterious, and we want to understand. So it could be just because of the way that they're moving, and maybe if you just have things that are moving in a certain pattern and they have no, you know, intelligence at all, they might be able to do this, but we don't know yet. We're testing this right now. Or it could be because they're made of cells. We know the cells are sensing. We know that when they bump into a pellet or are compressed, that their cells light up and they signal to their neighbors through calcium signaling. So the cells sense, they talk to their neighbors, and they act. So it could be that this is actually quite complex and intelligent behavior. We don't know yet. But regardless, they tend to kind of collect debris. So the kind of applications that we can envision that are pretty close to their current capabilities might be collecting microplastics in the ocean. At the moment, it's very hard to locate and clean up very small bits of plastic in our waterways.
Yeah.
Suppose you just deploy, you know, a lot of xenobots into the ocean and they just kind of swirl around.
No, don't do that. Do not do that. That's a bad idea.
So here's why it wouldn't be so bad. If you deployed a bunch of robots made out of metal and traditional materials into the environment, that could be a bad idea because they will degrade over time and they will pollute the environment. The very thing they're trying to do, which is clean up the environment, they'll actually make the problem worse in a lot of ways. But xenobots are just frog cells. And after about a week, they just disintegrate into dead skin cells. So in a way, and they can't reproduce. So in a way, they're actually much safer than any other form of technology for cleaning up the environment, if they could do that in the future.
Okay. That's a 2D environment you talk about on the surface or in a Petri dish. How on earth do you control motion in a useful way in a 3D space that might be the bloodstream, for example?
So we designed organisms that could walk along the bottom of a watery solution, but we also have ones that can swim. So if you just have a frog skin cell and you don't touch it and you let it develop, it will grow little hairs called cilia. And this stuff was traditionally, it's used just to move mucus through the tissue and through the skin.
Yeah.
But it's repurposed in the xenobots and the swimming ones just to let them swim. So the hairs kind of wave and it allows the organisms to swim in 3D. So yes, swimming's not a problem, and perhaps those would be more useful in our body. Although you also might want to have ones that, you know, scrape along the side of an artery to scrape out plaque. We don't know which ones are going to be more useful, and then we build them out of new cells. Maybe they're bigger, and we want them to walk. I don't know, but lots of possibilities.
And so you're talking about targeting viruses or bacteria or clearing up clogs in arteries. What other human applications might there be?
Yeah, so we can envision a few medical applications because, you know, these are composed of 100% living cells, so they're biocompatible and could potentially be made out of a patient's own cells, and maybe find tumors or deliver medicine directly to them. Or maybe just alert us to disease and kind of emit some signal that we can see when we go to the bathroom, for example. Maybe there's a green dye in our stool and we're like, uh-oh, we need to go to the doctor. So just early detection could be something that maybe they would be good at.
What if I wanted to do something bad with this research? Is that possible? If I were to program these cells, could this be used as an injectable, like, murder weapon?
I think that every single technology that we've ever made can be used for good or bad. I mean, you look at fire, and that has kept a lot of people from getting hypothermia or cholera, but also can be used to kill people. So at the moment, these things, the xenobots, are just skin and heart cells. So it's hard to imagine how a bad actor could use them more easily than, you know, weaponizing frogs themselves. So on the scale,
like sticking freaking laser beams on frogs.
Yeah, an army of frogs, you know, would be
much easier to do than this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So on the scale of things that I think xenobots are very safe in terms of their bioengineering. You know, it's just Lego bricks. They're GMO free. little synthetic biology things. So in that way, we feel like xenobots are much safer than a lot of the alternative technologies.
So before you made these xenobots, did people just presume that you couldn't take muscle cells and skin cells and get them to work together just by sticking them together in a Petri dish?
So I'm not sure exactly. That's not my area of expertise. So I am mostly in charge of the AI design. And my colleague Douglas Blackiston is the microsurgeon that actually builds the xenobots. Hmm. And from what I understand is that we were not sure that skin and heart tissue would just stick together like they did. And typically in synthetic biology, people are tinkering with genes And they're not so much coming from the other angle of just, you know, using cells like Legos. So in that sense, it was something new.
Is this much easier to do because you're talking about bigger organisms? You're not talking about having to rewrite the genes. You're not talking about the worry of, you know, genes somehow being passed down from generation to generation, or altering genes in a body that you don't know what the side effects are. Is the fact that you're dealing with fully made skin and heart cells from animals make it much easier to deploy this sort of technology quickly?
So at the moment, it's still a painstaking process to build one of them, but it seems like it could be a potential avenue to speed the production of synthetic organisms. So we're working on ways to automate their design. And then all you really need is access to a bunch of really early frog embryos. And one frog lays about 10,000 a week. So we don't have any problem getting the materials. But the problem we have, though, is automating this process, because it's not simply a matter of 3D bioprinting. If you print something that's living, if you can even do it at the resolution of a xenobot, which current technologies are not at that level yet, but if you could, it's not simply a matter of printing the living tissue, because living things don't stay still. So you need something more like 4D printers. You know, you need something that in the fourth dimension of time is constantly nudging and sculpting and making sure that this construct is becoming the kind of design that you want it to become, kind of guiding all this emergent behavior of development into something that's useful.
One final question for you, Sam. I mean, this is an organism that you have sort of created, as we said, sort of Frankenstein style, that can be in a petri dish, but actually move around size of a grain of sand and actually perform functions. What would be the difficulties in turning that into something that could live on dry land, for example?
Yeah, I think that we just need to use cells of an animal that is not an aquatic animal, and that's basically it. Well, we don't know yet. We still need to prove this, you know, in a future paper. But yeah, I don't see any technical limitations of a dry land future computer designed organism, but we'll find out.
This is just the most bizarre conversation I've had in this year, for sure. Sam Cregan, PhD student in evolutionary robotics and one of the creators of the Xenobots. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yep, thank you.
What did you make of that? Like, I have to say, I thought you needed more to make something move and live and go around like that. It's kind of, I mean, it goes back to, you know, this idea that I have that this is, everything is deterministic and we are just machines. Like when you hear that, you think that's all we are. We're machines. Human beings are machines. And to try and think of us as something higher or having more purpose or being more complicated or mysterious than that, maybe I think is perhaps just futile. Now it's time to look back at some of your emails and texts and tweets from last week. We were talking about left-handedness last week, and Brian and Drum makes a very good point. He says, Jonathan, why are we not taught to use both hands equally? Think of the advantages. I don't know. I know that obviously if you're in sport, they try and get you to kick with your left foot, but they don't really hammer home about it. It seems to me that would be a great advantage to be able to either go left or go right, but it doesn't seem to be something we focus in football. I guess it's a cost-benefit analysis. You know, you're naturally going to lean one way. What is the benefit of being able to do it also with your left? Spitball with this with me, Aidan. Like, yeah, if you could do it with both hands, what are the things that you're like, oh, if I could do that with both hands?
It is actually pretty hard to think of it outside of sport. Like, I remember playing football when I was a kid. I was told all the time, you need to practice your left foot. And I was the kind of kid who'd, like, instead of practicing his left foot, would get better at kicking with the outside of his right foot. Just like a workaround, a lazy workaround.
Right.
But you do notice it. The longer you go, the higher you go, it becomes really important and you wish you'd done it. It does get much better then just by being put into position. But like, I don't think outside
of sport,
I don't know anywhere else you would do it. Like, if you try to write your name with your left hand, it's just not worth the effort because it's so bad. You're so far behind your other hand.
Yeah.
I genuinely can't think of many pursuits where you would need to be ambidextrous beyond sport.
No, but that is because we have designed a world to favour the right hand.
Yeah, but also evolution, which has been going on for billions of years. Maybe evolution is just smarter than we are. And it's like, you don't need to have two hands doing the job. One of them will do it.
Yeah, I don't know, Brian. Like you say, think of the advantages. And myself and Aidan have spent a good, 60 seconds trying to think of a finding we haven't thought of.
That's exhaustive in our world.
Yeah. Louise from the Midlands says, I'm ambidextrous. I sucked the finger on my left hand when I'm a child. I eat the fork in my right hand. I ate with my fork in my right hand. I write with my right hand, but could with my left if I had to. So please explain my type. Well, you're just brilliant, Louise. But you are ambidextrous. I don't know what you mean by explain your type. What does she mean by that?
I think she just wanted you to call her.
You're
brilliant.
Great. You're great. No, I'd love to know. Does that help you? Because we could answer Brian's question by getting in touch with Louise. Does that help you in any way, being ambidextrous, apart from being able to say, "Look at me"? I mean, if you could, and I can't do this, by the way, if you could write at the same time and think of two different thought processes, you could potentially write two pages of a book at once. That would be mega. But really, what
that's
is
a whole,
actually
like a much more amazing?
It's a more
skill
difficult. It is. It is. Although there's a guy, but there's a guy apparently who can play along in his mind five different songs of different tempos, and he can sing along. Then he can just switch from one, and he'll hit the exact part of that song. So he can switch from song to song. So he would say, press play on five songs in his brain. And he can switch in between them. That's how good his mental agility is. Wouldn't that be amazing talent? I mean, obviously, there's probably better uses for that. But it's being able to compartmentalize different thoughts and be able to run them all at the same time.
Yeah, it's a thoroughly amazing and pointless talent.
Well, I mean, surely for music composition, you're a musician. Like I can't play the guitar and sing at the same time. I lose my I've no rhythm that way. Surely if you can do that, if you could separate these different things, that would be useful.
Yeah, you could. Well, I suppose if you could do, it might give you interesting ideas about different rhythms.
You know them mad fellas who like play the drum, play the kazoo, sing, have a guitar, the one-man band fellas.
Dick Van Dyke.
Well, not just Dick Van, but also, perfect example. Why aren't they geniuses? Like, if you can do that, surely you can solve the world's problems. Like,
I feel like
it's, you know, the potential of someone who can do a one man band thing is up here, and what they actually achieve is down there. Like a one man band thing is like, oh yeah, that's grand, and then you move on.
I'm sort of conscious of bursting your bubble here, but it looks more complicated than it is. Like I can't do the one man band, or I haven't tried to. But if you're playing a guitar and singing, you need to be able to keep the rhythm, right? So you could do that. Like I could.
Yeah, but there are some guys who can do like one instrument in left, one instrument in right, feet and.
Yeah, but your feet are sort of automatic because that's keeping your rhythm anyway.
You're very hard to impress, so shut up. Another person says Coriolis force. Is that what creates left-handed and right-handers? So the Coriolis force is the spin of the earth. And it's different on the northern hemisphere from the southern hemisphere. And so you get sort of anti-clockwise hurricanes on the top and clockwise on the bottom, or vice versa. Forget it. I'm not ever going to remember that. I don't know if we could really, that would be a real everything is connected sort of thing if that was one of the reasons why people are left-handed or right-handed. But also you'd think that you'd have a whole continent of left-handed people, right? So I don't think so. Although the Coriolis force is not just, I think, in this closed system of the earth. I think there's more to it. And then we got some other strange texts that I never understand. I'm not sure what people, maybe their buttock texted in the show or whatever it is. But we did get someone tweeting us this factoid, which we've covered, I think, on the program. And this is that nearly every scientist who has used mice or rats to study depression is familiar with the forced swim test. An animal is dropped into a tank of water where researchers watch to see how long it tries to stay afloat. In theory, a depressed rodent will give up more quickly than a happy one, an assumption that has guided decades of research on antidepressant medicines and genetic modifications intended to induce depression in lab mice. Yeah, this is, there are a couple of different mice tests they do, And a lot of depression drugs started out as being based on this finding that if you dangle a mouse over water, if they struggle for more than 3 minutes, it's not depressed. And if it just goes, oh, drop me then, let me drown, after like a minute, it just stops struggling, then it is depressed. Now, that to me seems like a pretty poor analog for the extraordinarily complex mental fog that is the spectrum of depression. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to producer. No, I'm not. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, who is on research, and on sound, Jojo Cardoza. We'll be back with more future proofing your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.